From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Congress hears testimony on immigration rights for people with serious medical problems. Also today, WBUR's newest poll on what issues matter most to people as we head into 2020.
Rather than just focusing on what the candidates are saying, on the pundits and the polls, we want to frame our reporting around the question, to what extent are the candidates responding to what people want?
We'll dig into those results and take your calls. And the latest on the disturbing allegations against the new Patriots wide receiver, Antonio Brown.
These allegations in the lawsuit are false.
We've looked into the situation. We're taking it very seriously all the way through the organization.
We'll take your calls on how the team got here and what they should do now. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's been 18 years since the 9/11 terror attacks, and we begin our show by remembering that day and the nearly 3,000 people who perished in New York, Washington, D.C., and Pennsylvania. The two airplanes that struck the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001, took off from Boston Logan Airport. 206 victims of the attacks that day had close ties to Massachusetts. Public officials, friends, and family gathered at ceremonies around the Commonwealth today to remember those we lost. In New York, relatives and officials read the names of victims.
Maria Jakubiak.
Robert Adrian Jalbert.
Ernest James.
Griselda E. James.
Mark Stephen Jardine.
Amy Nicole Jarrett.
And in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, Pastor Paul M. Britton invoked the spirit of the 40 people who perished there.
Their miracle is our possibility. Their 18 years ago is our today and tomorrow.
At the Pentagon in Washington, D.C., President Trump talked about our grief, both collective and personal.
For the families who join us, this is your anniversary of personal and permanent loss. It's the day that has replayed in your memory 1,000 times over, the last kiss, the last phone call, the last time hearing those precious words, I love you, then the attack.
In May, author Mitchell Zuckoff talked to us here at Radio Boston about rethinking how we remember 9/11.
I want 9/11 not to be simply a math problem, if you will, where we know the number of people killed. But when you connect to Elaine or Colonel Wills crawling across a burning floor in the Pentagon with a woman on her back, you will never forget those people.
18 years later, we remember. We will never forget. We turn now to WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins, who joins us from Capitol Hill, where an emergency hearing on medical deferred action for critically ill immigrants is underway. Kimberly, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tiziana.
Hi there. So, Kimberly, this hearing is happening before the House Oversight and Reform Subcommittee on Civil Rights and Civil Liberties. Remind us for the reason of this hearing.
Yes. So Shannon Dooling, our WBUR colleague, broke the story last month about immigrants, people, non-citizens who were in the United States, but who had gotten deferrals because they were seeking at times life-saving medical treatment, that those deferrals were being declined and they were getting notices that they had 33 days to leave the country. And so this hearing was called for by Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, who have among her constituents about 20 of these folks. And so it was called and it was scheduled for today, and it's going on right now. And you can hear I just ducked out into a hallway on Capitol Hill to talk to you.
Yeah, I can hear it. So what's been happening in the hearing?
So we have heard from a number of people affected by this policy, people who had been denied this deferral status. We've also heard from former and current immigration officials about the reasoning behind what this program is and isn't, according to them. And, of course, we've heard lawmakers from both sides of the aisle on this committee really sparring over this issue, as they often do, of issues on issues of immigration.
Kimberly, what have we learned about the Trump administration's reasons for discontinuing this?
Yeah, not a whole lot. Daniel Renault, who is the Associate Director of Field Operations at USCIS, started at the outset by saying that because there is litigation, there are lawsuits that have been filed over this, that he was limited in what he could say. And just as I was leaving the hearing room, he declined to answer what this policy exactly was, whether it had changed, or whether, you know, if it has changed, what it has changed. Too. We've heard from some Republican members of the committee who basically characterize this as just USCIS passing this over to ICE to administer, that it's not ending. But Democrats disagreed strongly with that characterization, said the program was indeed canceled. So there's still a lot of uncertainty about exactly what happened.
So Kimberly, we've got a cut from Daniel Renault of USCIS kind of explaining how deferred action at least is different from programs like DACA. Here he is.
Deferred action is a discretionary decision made on a case-by-case basis. Deferred action is not an immigration benefit or specific form of relief. It is a decision not to act.
So is the administration's position essentially that, hey, we don't have to do this? Is that what we're hearing from officials today?
Yes. So they're trying to make a different distinction here between what is a benefit from being in the country and what is not. And what they were saying is that this is just a discretionary non-action that's being taken for people who otherwise would be subject to removal proceedings. Again, Democrats disagreed with that. They said for a lot of these folks, they were brought here for the purpose of receiving this treatment. So certainly they were not expecting to be at risk of being removed in just over a month's time, that this is really something that they have seen in the past, programs changing, and the administration trying to deny that these changes are being made.
Kimberly, is there anything you'd highlight from specific testimony today?
Yeah, so we've heard, as I said, there were people who were on the receiving end of these treatments. Jonathan Sanchez, he was among those. He's here. He's a 16-year-old from Honduras who has cystic fibrosis. His sister passed away from cystic fibrosis, and he is receiving treatment in Boston. He's one of the people also that WBUR spoke to when it first broke. And at today's hearing, he says he needs to stay in the U.S. to receive that treatment.
The day our lawyers told us that the medical deferred action program was canceled, I started crying and telling my mom, I don't want to die. I don't want to die. If I go back to Honduras, I will die.
And we also heard from Dr. Fiona Donaher. She testified. She's a pediatrician at Mass General Hospital, and she said it's about more than just treating patients.
This is not just bad medicine. It is unconscionably inhumane. My colleagues at Mass General and I respectfully urge USCIS to embrace the moral imperative of permitting our young patients the opportunity to heal and to thrive.
Those are strong and impassioned arguments, Kimberly. Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley was among those calling for this hearing and inviting that testimony today. What did she have to say?
Yes, she pushed back strongly at some Republican colleagues, folks like Mark Meadows, who basically accused the Democrats of trying to create panic with this hearing, and that this was really a problem that was only affecting a few people, and the Democrats were blowing it out of proportion. Let's hear what she said.
Our colleagues across the aisle have stated outright and implied that there are dramatics happening on this side of the aisle. No drama, just hard facts.
So to that point of sides of the aisle, I tried to follow the hearing on Twitter as best as I could this afternoon. It looked like there was some partisan sparring, Kimberly, sort of discussions about cruelty versus security. What can you tell us about that?
There absolutely was a partisan divide, and Tom Homan, who was known as an immigration hardliner, he was among those testifying. He's a former acting ICE chief, and President Trump appointed him as his border czar in June. Let's listen to what he said.
You want to talk about family separation. You want to talk about terrible detention conditions. You want to talk about, you know, this deferred action. And I get it. It's all important. But when are we going to talk about fixing the problem, saving lives, and securing our nation?
And at one point, Homan really got into a verbal debate with Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. She was acting as the chairperson of the hearing at that moment, and she had to actually bang her gavel to get him to stop talking. So there were definitely some fireworks.
Okay, so fireworks, impassioned testimony. Kimberly, what happens from here?
It's really unclear. I mean, one solution in a normal world would be a legislative one. If Congress passed a law that established clear guidelines and really gave some protections to people who are here receiving these treatments, that would solve the problem. Of course, we not only have a divided Congress with Democrats in control of the House and Republicans in control of the Senate, there is little to no chance that President Trump would sign something like that. So in the meantime, we continue to have these hearings. We continue to bring people in and draw attention to it. Congresswoman Presley said that it's the work from news reports like Shannon's, from immigrant advocates, that brought this to light in the first place, and she sees that as an important job for the Oversight Committee to continue to do that.
And of course, our own Shannon Dooling has really contributed to this as well, as you mentioned earlier.
Yes, she broke this story.
So WBUR Senior News Correspondent Kimberly Atkins, thanks for being with us today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Stay with us. Coming up, results from WBUR's newest poll on what issues matter most to you. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. WBUR's senior political reporter Anthony Brooks is here in the studio. Welcome back, Anthony.
Hey, good to be here, Tiziana.
So Anthony has the results of a new WBUR poll that digs into the issues that matter the most to voters heading into the 2020 presidential election. Anthony, tell us about the poll. What was BUR trying to find out?
Okay, well, basically what we're trying to find out is what do voters want the candidates to be talking about. But let me back up a little bit, because the idea behind this poll came from Jay Rosen, professor of journalism at New York University, who's been a longtime sort of follower, studier, blogging about and often criticizing political journalism in this country. And his biggest beef, one that many of us share, by the way, is that too much of our political coverage is what we call horse race journalism. It's obsessed with the polls, who's ahead, who's behind, with the political pundits, with the so-called political experts. And there is a lot of this kind of coverage because it's easy to do. You know, you commission a poll, you talk to some experts, report on it, wash, rinse, repeat. And there's a place for that, Tiziana, and we can talk about that. And we certainly do it too. I mean, WBUR has a great relationship with a fabulous pollster named Steve Cazella, who did this poll. But the idea here is that Jay Rosen from NYU, says what we need more of is election coverage that springs from what matters most to voters. And so he calls for something that he calls the citizen's agenda. Here's what he says.
And the citizen's agenda is an attempt to reposition election coverage closer to the concerns of the average voter.
So that's what led us to take on this project and this particular poll, which we can talk about.
So let's dig a little into it. What is the citizen's agenda based on this poll?
Yeah, right. So healthcare. It comes down to healthcare and a whole bunch of other issues. But basically, healthcare was the top issue picked by 63% of voters overall, 70% of self-identified Democrats. So you can see why it's a key issue in the Democratic primary. And by the way, this was a poll of about 600 or so voters in the WBUR listening area, eastern Massachusetts and southern New Hampshire. The other issues that were cited by majorities of the region's voters: jobs and wages and the economy, immigration, Social Security, and Medicare. And then there was sort of a third tier of issues, climate change and gun policy. So those kinds of – those are some of the issues. So these are issues that we're hearing a lot about on the campaign trail, which I found somewhat encouraging. But there were also some interesting distinctions in the polling among who wants what and who favors what.
So listeners, you just heard the list from Anthony from the poll. What about you? What issues are most important to you as we enter the, you know, the 2020 season in earnest? Are politicians and media talking about the issues enough? Are you hearing what you want to hear? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or send us a tweet at Radio Boston. I'm going to add another voice in just a second. But before I do, Anthony, the other question I have is, what about the Republican side, the Democrat side? Did we see party differences?
Yeah, we really did. It's interesting because when we talked to Democrats and asked – and by the way, we did this poll in sort of two ways. The poll asked an open-ended question, and basically the open-ended question was, what do you want the candidates for president to be discussing as they compete for your votes? The other way we asked them was we asked them to choose from a list of issues, healthcare, climate change, gun policy, immigration, and so on. And so from those responses, we were able to put these answers together. So Democrats, as we said, they sort of chose an array of issues with healthcare at the top, but then came jobs and the economy, immigration, climate change, guns, defeating Trump. These are all sort of what issues that the Democrats care about. Republicans, by contrast, 50% or more of Republicans selected just two issues, immigration and jobs, wages, and the economy. And if you think about that, it makes a lot of sense because, of course, these are the issues that Donald Trump spends most of his time talking about and, frankly, ran for president on. I mean, immigration, we all know his hardline policies. And, you know, he's hopeful that a strong economy is going to be his ticket to reelection. So these are the two issues that Republicans are spending a lot of time focusing on.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK if you want to join the conversation. And I do want to have someone else join the conversation. Tito Jackson, he's the CEO of Verdant Medical, a Massachusetts medical and recreational cannabis company. He's also a former Boston city councilor, and he ran for mayor in 2017. Tito, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So what were your reactions to the poll results?
So I think it's quite interesting. I think I agree that the press often overlooks very good candidates. I won't speak about any of my aspirations in the past, but
present company excluded, right, Tito?
And they exclude them based on things like money. Right. So that's one of the interesting pieces, that there are consistent and constant stories that seek to categorize people not based on their ideas or the qualitative measures that are out there, but that are based on the money. I also think oftentimes the press is smitten by controversy over substance. Right. So,
what are you talking about? I have no idea what you're talking about.
Or and a quip over quality. Right. So if you can zing somebody in a debate, distracting from, in certain cases, an individual's own shortcomings, you have an opportunity to kind of shift things. But I think Trump's messaging is obviously working. Right. So you have
that title line, man.
Yeah. So you have immigration and jobs at the top. And much of this is Trump created crisis.
Yeah.
Right. So his policies actually, in terms of the framing, allows for him and his followers to actually stay in line.
Anthony, you wanted to react to
something. Well, it's just interesting. I mean, I really appreciate some of Tito's concerns about political coverage in general. And I want to read a letter that we actually received in response to the poll we did this morning from a listener. It's just the kind of response we were hoping to get. And so I'll just read it, and then we can talk about it. I'm just going to read part of it. Dear WBUR, I was excited to hear that you'll be trying to report on what its listeners want to know about the candidates and not just reporting on the horse race, a term I've been using to criticize political reporting. A lot of people don't really tune in to who is running and what they're espousing until well into the campaign, and so they need to learn about their platforms, not just who is up or down in the polls. I know that political reporters are paying attention from the get-go, so they know where each candidate stands. So to them, the horse race maybe is the most interesting thing to report, but we, just the tuning in public, or the just tuning in public, want to learn more about the candidates' platforms. So I think that's sort of a key point that we're trying to absorb here. It's not that we're going to sort of change the way we do our job dramatically, but it's trying to keep in the front of our minds, what do the listeners want to hear out there? What do they care about? And I think Tito put his finger on something. They care about a bunch of issues that we may not be reporting. So just one more thing from this letter. By the way, I should say who wrote it. Nanny Almquist. One more thing. Last week, I heard a long interview with Andrew Yang. I wasn't even aware of his name, let alone his platform, and I was fascinated and hopeful. I want to hear more from him. His ideas are a radical departure, but maybe they might work to help this nation if they get covered and implemented. So that's the point.
So let's add a couple of caller voices to that, and then Tito, I'll give you a chance to respond. John from Franklin, you're on the line. What do you want to share?
What I want to talk about is the fact that I want a candidate who acknowledges that the system in its entirety is rigged against working class people and is rigged in favor of wealthy people. And you can give working class people education, you can give them job skills, you can give them jobs, but it's not going to change the fact that they're still going to be struggling week to week to live paycheck to paycheck.
Thanks for that, John. I'm going to add Peter from Warren to that, too. Peter, go ahead.
Yes, I think that it's kind of a twofold thing. My two big ones are climate change and then here inequality in treatment almost historically of the poor. And the big thing there is that as climate change, which is very real, is going to come down on us in all sorts of ways, poor people are going to be the most affected. And I really wish people would talk more about the connectivity of that and how do we deal with it and how do our grandchildren deal with it? We'll be gone, people like myself, but what about them?
Thanks, Peter. So, Tito, you know, we've got a rigged system, income inequality, climate change. Do we have candidates addressing these issues? Are these the key issues you've been hearing?
No, I definitely think we have candidates who are addressing the issues. You have candidates who have plans. As you hear Elizabeth Warren every day speaking about another plan, I think it's really important that we peel back what these plans actually mean, but also I think we need to dig down. When we say these issues, I think when we say jobs, wages, and the economy, right? So we have essentially full employment, but a lot of people work for Uber. A lot of people work for Lyft. So you have folks who are underemployed who are working their butts off on a day-to-day basis. So they technically have a job, but if they were to lose, and there was a recent study that said, hey, you know, if when we look at emergency funds, folks don't have $400 to have something bad actually happen to them. So I think there's another layer of peeling back when we categorize these things in that space. I think the one other piece is looking at people who are voting outside of their interest. Right. I think that's a really interesting component.
And you think people do that? You think people vote outside their interests?
Many of the states, you know, when we're looking at, you know, some of the folks in pivotal states like Pennsylvania, like Florida, Ohio, Colorado, you're looking at folk who are being affected by the relationship of the United States, Trump, and China.
Mm-hmm.
Folks whose earnings futures, the gentleman was nice enough to bring up people's grandchildren, there are farmers who and coal miners and folks who thought Trump was on their side, but they are really being bandied about in this space.
So we've got a caller, 1-800-423-8255, to join the conversation. Muhammad from Worcester, I think you have some thought about this voting for or against your own interests. Go ahead.
Yeah, in some sense. My biggest thing is I want to talk about the candidates themselves. I'm talking about Democratic candidates. They really get too much into the detail. They're unable to articulate clearly their views. And I'm talking about, for example, when you talk to immigration, they took a position that's indefensible about giving illegal immigrants, you know, health care. They can't even support the current system. All they got to do is support the system. You know, secondly, you look at how they're not even supporting labor. These are things that can help a lot of the issues that are happening today. But I am worried because the candidates, and these are politicians that have been in politics for so long, can't even articulate these issues in a very convincing way without having to put out a slide, you know, in real people terms.
Okay, thanks for that, Muhammad. We're going to add one more. Jack from Framingham, you go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I want to say two things.
First of all, this is not normal times. So for me, the number one policy is who's the best to defeat Donald Trump. And the fifth most important policy is who's the best to defeat Donald Trump. It's not normal times. But my other point is that a pretty wise person, I'm too bad I can't quote it, but I wrote down the quote. He says, if you look at the presidential election, we're not talking about congressional Senate, presidential election is determined when the person goes into the ballot box, either who's my guy or do I hate the other guy enough, not so I'll vote for, you know, the first person. 15% of people hated Hillary. They hated her. That's why they voted for Trump. 35%, he was their guy.
All right, let's pick it up from there, Jack. Thanks. So Anthony's nodding. And
yeah, there's just an interesting detail. This is one of the things that surprised me about this poll, and that is the Democrats' attitude toward how the candidates should take on Donald Trump. And this really surprised me. It's one of the most interesting things. So this idea, should candidates deal with Trump, talk about him all the time, represent themselves as the alternative to Trump, sort of like Joe Biden does, let's say, as an example, or should they more or less ignore Trump and really talk about their own vision and give the voters a sort of affirmative vision to vote for, more in line with what Elizabeth Warren's doing? So on the open-ended question in our poll, when we just sort of said, what do you want the candidates to be talking about? Less than 10% talked about beating Trump or impeaching Trump as being an important issue. But when we put defeating Trump in a list of issues, it becomes one of the top factors. So that tells me that there are a lot of people out there who, of course, they want to beat Trump, but they want their candidates to be talking about how to defeat Trump, an alternative to Trump.
Okay, Tito, you've been a candidate. So how does a candidate understand those mixed messages from listeners and voters?
A candidate needs to get their butt out in the streets and actually connect with people. And I think that's one of the things that we saw from the last election, where Hillary had, I heard, no events in August, right? So you need to actually be connecting with folks. And I think when it comes to this go-round, I think Muhammad, we might differ on some of the specifics, but
Muhammad, the caller from Worcester.
Yes, but we need some top-line messaging. And this is where oftentimes Republicans do a really good job at dumbing things down or actually totally twisting something that you may think is one thing and switching it over to the other side. I also think we have to acknowledge that 53% of white women voted for Trump last time. Right. So that's going to be a very critical population and what's pivotal in the last go round and in particular in states like Pennsylvania, you're going to need to see Obama numbers coming out of places like Philly. And so I think it's really critical that when we think about the youth vote and folks getting excited, engaged, registering to vote. And the other piece is, as a Democrat, you can't get beat in energy. That's bad when folks aren't excited, engaged, and actually able to kind of connect with you in that space.
So, Anthony, you've been out on the campaign trail already. Are you seeing engagement and energy? Are people showing up at events? What's your take on that?
Yeah, I think they are. I mean, so most of my attention has been spent up in New Hampshire for obvious reasons, because that's sort of our backyard. It's the first in the nation primary, and all the candidates are coming through there. And I've been struck, by a lot of energy, and you've seen it grow, too. I mean, you know, you can go up to a campaign event on a Tuesday morning in the middle of July, and somehow there are 400 people showing up to hear a candidate. And if you look at someone who's ahead in the polls like Elizabeth Warren, her events are getting bigger and bigger and bigger and more a lot more energy. Same with Bernie Sanders and a bunch of the other candidates as well. So, yes, I think there's a ton of energy out there. And I think the energy for now is coming from the Democrats because there is a lot of concern about the man in the White House and a lot of desire to find a candidate who can beat him in 2020.
So, Tito, one of our callers, Jack, said, you know, these are not ordinary times. And one of the things that made me think of was, so you go back to 2016, you go to the exit polls after voters have voted. They come out. You ask, we asked them, you know, what they cared about. And 52% said the economy, which is still one of the top on the list. But only 13% said immigration. And 18% actually said terrorism, which really no one's talking about now. So what has caused these big shifts? You know, 13% immigration then, and now it's on the top of the list.
You have absolute gaslighting that comes out of the White House on a regular basis. And I'll say, interesting, when I ran for mayor of the city of Boston, every single week there was a crisis. And beginning with the Muslim ban. And we were at, I don't know if you were at the airport with us, and just seeing the angst that came out of that. And so I think Donald Trump uses his reality show background to actually manipulate reality. And so what you essentially have happening is that his messaging and his policies, turning up the heat every single time. Last week we're dealing with immigrants who have a medical issue. And you're saying, well, throw those folks out, too. Characterizations of Bohemians as well as Puerto Ricans who are U.S. citizens. These pronouncements and this, again, these artificial crisis points that he actually creates really does begin to affect the reality, which is a very, very sad reality. And that's why Democrats do need to figure out messaging that is going to drive people, engage people, and also pull those individuals who are in the middle. Because this, let's be very honest, there's a 20% group in the middle that we're really vying for to win this.
So, Anthony,
I was just going to add, I agree with Tito, but I would just add, I think Trump is sort of smarter in a way to use immigration. I mean, cynical, but smart, because immigration in a way has sort of stood in for a lot of issues that has left a lot of Americans feeling cut out and not sort of partaking in the political system. So Trump is able to sort of manufacture this immigration crisis, which appeals to a lot of folks who are feeling left out and who suddenly feel like, oh, okay, we've got a target. We've got a way to target our frustration and our sense of being left out of this political system. And I think that's one of the reasons why immigration has become a top issue among so many voters, because Trump has manufactured it for reasons that are real.
All right. I am looking forward to continuing this conversation. For now, Anthony Brooks, WBUR senior political reporter. Thanks for being with us.
Sure. My pleasure.
And Tito Jackson, he's the CEO of Verdant Medical, a cannabis company. He's a former Boston city councilor, and you ran for mayor in 2017. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you,
Tito,
so much for having me.
I appreciate it. So listen, stay with us. More ahead. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering. We turn now to some troubling news revolving around newly acquired Patriots wide receiver Antonio Brown. Listeners, just a warning, this segment will include some disturbing language and possibly triggers for you. A former trainer has accused Brown of multiple instances of rape and sexual assault. Brown has denied the allegations. Joining me in Studio 3 to give us the latest and figure out where we go from here is WBUR sports and society reporter Shira Springer. Shira, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Chris, thanks to you as well.
Good to be here.
So we'll talk with Shira and Chris in a second, but what do you make of this news? Should the Pats release Brown? Should the Pats have taken Brown? Should the NFL suspend him while an investigation is going on, or should he be allowed to play? Do you trust the NFL to do the right thing? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So, Shira, I'm going to start with you. You're reporting on the story. What do we know about this lawsuit?
Well, as you mentioned, Antonio Brown has been accused of rape by a former trainer. Brittany Taylor is her name. She says Brown sexually assaulted her on three occasions. And this is according to a civil lawsuit filed yesterday in the Southern District of Florida. Brown denies the allegations, and the attorney representing Brown basically says that he will pursue all legal remedies to not only clear his name, but to also protect other professional athletes against false accusations.
And Shira, one of those three included rape.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes, as you mentioned, yes, a rape allegation.
All right. Now, I know both Bill Belichick and Drew Rosenhaus, who is Antonio Brown's agent, have addressed the story. What are they saying?
Well, I think the basic takeaway from both Belichick and Drew Rosenhaus is we're standing behind our guy. Belichick, obviously being Belichick, didn't want to get into it. He was more, let's focus on Miami and the Miami Dolphins. That's the next game. But he was basically, we're taking it day by day and, you know, saying, well, we'll deal with it as it comes. We're concerned. We understand the seriousness of this lawsuit and the allegations, but, you know, we are focused on football, which is what he prefers to do. And Drew Rosenhaus is basically saying, you know, let this play out. You know, let's wait and see what the investigation says, because, you know, the Antonio Brown side of things is that there was a consensual sexual relationship, and that this is not the sexual assault and the rape that's alleged. So that's where they stand. They are also saying in response that this is a scheme to get money out of Antonio Brown, and that there's more there than, you know, just these sexual assault allegations. You need to look deeper. That is their side of the story.
Okay.
Of course, we have her side of the story, which is laid out very thoroughly in the lawsuit, in great detail about, you know, how he went to her house and how the actual rape happened and the other incidents happened. So I think it's going to take some investigation and into what actually happened.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. So, Chris, before we open it up a little bit, you know, this is only the latest trouble for Antonio Brown. So remind us quickly.
Can we get to, you know, I mean, this has been like just an amazing, I mean, I think one of the things that Chris and I were talking about before this was that we all knew when the Patriots signed Antonio Brown that he would be a distraction, that there would be some kind of incident that happened along the way. This, he has a history of this. We were talking about cryotherapy gate, helmet gate, him undermining the authority of the coach and general manager of the Raiders, his former team. I don't think
even before that, it goes back to the Steelers.
Exactly.
He sat
forced
week 17
his way out of
game
there
with their playoff chances, yes, on the line. Ended up getting benched because he didn't show up for
practice.
Well,
let's be honest.
All week.
He forced his way out of the Steelers organization. Then he forced his way out of the Raiders organization because, as everybody sort of believed, he wanted to play for the Patriots to have a shot at the Super Bowl. But as Chris and I were talking about beforehand, I think we all knew something like this was coming, but none of us expected, at least I'll speak for myself, expected that it would be an incident or something of this severity, and this big and this serious. I mean, I think that's the thing that really throws you, for all the trouble he's been in his career, on the field, off the field, and there are many incidents. This was not what, you know, I think everybody saw coming. And then the other thing that is sort of interesting, another interesting wrinkle here, is that his agent, we were talking about his agent speaking on ESPN earlier today, his agent basically said, we anticipated this coming, yeah, for some time.
We've got this. Okay. Let's hear it.
Antonio and I have been unfortunately anticipating this possibility.
Holy cow. Okay, so wait. So if, yeah, we've been anticipating, yeah, trouble, and he and his lawyer have been anticipating this possibility, where is the due diligence prior to him coming in?
Well, it also raises the question, did Drew Rosenhaus's agent conceal this from the Patriots, or did the Patriots sign Antonio Brown knowing full well that there were rape allegations pending against him, that this could come down the pike? Either way, it's a bad look for all,
right,
parties.
I cannot imagine the team knew about the actual lawsuit and these allegations specifically.
Me neither.
It boggles the mind that they would make the signing if they knew about these specific allegations. So, yeah, that to me says that Antonio Brown and Drew Rosenhaus hid this from the team, assuming they knew,
yes,
prior to the weekend, which would be unbelievable.
All right. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mary Paul from Merrimack, Massachusetts. Go right ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment that how can we possibly trust the NFL at all when the owner of the Patriots, Mr. Kraft, he was, you know, allegedly involved in a massage ring in Florida, and nothing, there's been no speak of it. So I'm concerned about that.
All right. So thanks for that,
That's
Mary
not
Paul.
Even allegedly. He definitely was involved in that.
Yeah. But I mean, I think the caller brings up a good point, which is the bigger point, which is how can we trust the NFL to investigate this in a way that is thorough and fair when they have, talk about a history of malfeasance, really, when it comes to investigations. You know, they have failed on numerous occasions to properly investigate players who have been accused of domestic violence, who have been accused of sexual assault. This goes back years and years and years. We can talk about Ray Rice. We can talk about Tyreek Hill. We can talk about any number of players in the NFL who the NFL has failed to get all the information when they claim they were doing a proper investigation. I think that's my big concern now. Do you trust the NFL? And then she also brings up an interesting point with Robert Kraft and the allegations and what happened in Florida at the day spa, the massage parlor, which is because of what's happened with Antonio Brown, every scandal, every legal issue the Patriots have faced over the last 2, 3, 4, 5 years are going to be stirred up now because people are going to look back at this history of the organization that has taken such pride in having a very strong moral code. Robert Kraft has said that, he doesn't, zero tolerance for domestic violence and abusers of women. He has, funded initiatives locally to, do domestic violence education in local schools. So, there's going to be a magnifying glass on all of that at this point.
And Chris, Shira raises such an important point because there is this sort of ethos around the Patriots, which is the Patriot way, and this is how we do it, and we just focus on doing our job, and we only bring in people we like. Does this whole situation give the lie to that ethos?
I mean, if you've been paying attention, there's no such thing as the Patriot way. That is a PR spin that the Krafts like
to put out there. But it's trademarked.
Oh, of course. I'm sure there's plenty of merchandise.
True that. No team trademark slogans more than the Patriots.
It's never been a Belichick thing. Belichick is, are you a cheaper value for what you're going to give me on the field? Am I going to get more out of you than I'm paying you? Great. Bring you in. We'll figure out the rest.
Wait, was Antonio Brown cheap?
For what he's bringing, you're talking about one of the five best, if not the best receiver in the league. So absolutely.
And you're only out potentially $15 million. Who knows if he'll
They're get, not
gonna I was going to say, who knows if he'll get all of that because, who knows how much he'll actually play given the latest news.
So let's take another call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to be at the table with us in the conversation. Charlotte from Brighton, go ahead.
Hi, I just wanted to weigh in on this and make a comment about how people frequently dismiss women that make accusations of sexual assault against wealthy or famous men by saying that she's just after money or she's making it up or she's just after this and that. And what they often don't take into account is the fact that this woman's life and all of her private information is going to be revealed to the entire public. She's going to be having people calling her horrifying names, having people going after her friends and family, and that what she's doing is extremely brave. And I just really think that that's something that people don't take into account. And when they say things like, oh, she's probably after money or she's after publicity or that. The publicity is not good publicity. It's
Thanks,
terrifying.
Charlotte. You make a strong point. I'm going to let Tracy from Plymouth add on to that. Tracy, go ahead.
That's very similar to the idea that I was saying, is that I'm just horrified at all the comments I'm seeing, on social media defending him and accusing her. Well, why did she let it happen 3 times? Why was she even there? Why didn't she quit? Why isn't she pressing criminal charges? Like all of these things. Why are we judging her? Why are we defending him?
Okay, so let's put one more caller in this mix then. Kathy, you're calling us from Route 3. Kathy, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead.
How are you doing? Yeah, okay, I'm on the other side of that. A parent, a mother of 2 college football players. And let me tell you about the rape culture, man. If 2 people end up drunk right now in America in college and they wake up and have regrets, it's his fault. These little you-know-whats are all over these guys. They're the celebrities on campus. They beg them for it. They'll crawl in their beds. They'll give them anything. But when they wake up and the guy doesn't want to keep a relationship going, it's she too.
Okay. Kathy, I can hear how strongly you feel protective of your sons in that call. So we have, we are looking at an event here that falls on a culture divide that's happening in our country right now that the NFL has found itself on the fault line of repeatedly. Why can't the NFL get off this fault line, Chris?
Honestly, because the NFL is about making money. And every decision they make is going to be about, is this going to hurt the bottom line or help the bottom line? And so world. That's why you see the knee-jerk reactions to stories when all of a sudden there is major public outcry on an issue, when the Ray Rice video gets released or something along those lines, because all of a sudden the NFL sees, oh, we could be losing dollars here. And that's really what moves the needle.
So I would say not only is the NFL about money, but the teams are about winning. And let's be honest.
Because winning gets you money.
Well, winning gets you money, but I mean, that's the priority here. And let's be honest, if this was the 40th man on the Patriots roster, you know, and isn't, you know, he would be released. They are sticking with Antonio Brown, standing behind him because he has the potential to take a very good team to another Super Bowl.
So, Shira, I do feel like sort of in pursuit of the facts, we should mention that his side is arguing that she sought money from him earlier. Yes. Can you tell us just a little bit about that?
Yeah, that she was pursuing a business relationship with him and that this is all about the money and that is, you know, I mean, it's an extortion. I mean, basically, she feels she didn't get the money she should have had from a business relationship she was pursuing with him. And that, you know, and you know, that's what the agent and the lawyer are claiming. And, you know, as the caller brings up, you know, that's a pretty common way to kind of attack the credibility of rape victims.
Yeah, there's so much about this that feels like the classic he said, she said.
Yes. You know, and people are wondering also about the timing. You know, why now? You know, why, you know, days after he signed with the most successful NFL team in, you know, recent years. So what is the, you know, what's going on there? Is there some extra motivation because she knew that she would get more attention if he was on the Patriots versus on the Raiders?
Yeah.
Quite frankly, I think you get attention anytime Antonio Brown is involved.
Let's take a couple more calls. Doug from Sharon, you're on the line. What do you have to say?
Well, just listening, as often happens, people are assuming that the entities that are involved are other than what they really are. The woman in question has a lawyer, I'm sure. Brown, I'm sure, has a lawyer, already has one, probably has several lining up to take his case, as does she. And this case is going to be in the court, not in NFL.
So you're saying that this is about the law, not the NFL, Doug? Is that right?
Well, it has an impact on NFL. But the reality is the man's being accused of something. Right or wrong, I don't know. Okay? I know he's not got the greatest reputation. But he's being accused of something, and something horrible. But the court has to take that over, not NFL,
okay.
Not the Patriots.
Gotcha.
Not anybody else.
Okay. Thanks, Doug. So that's an interesting point, and it does make me wonder, do we have times in the past where we've had these cases come forward with the NFL and we've seen legal action later that got to the forefront? Rather than what the NFL is doing about it, it's what the law is doing about it. I guess my perception is no. Mostly these wind up staying inside the NFL, Chris.
Well, and especially because this is going to be a civil lawsuit as opposed to any sort of criminal charges. So there has never been a case. So there's been a lot of talk about whether the league will put Antonio Brown on the commissioner's exempt list. They've never put a player on the exempt list, which would mean he gets paid but doesn't get to play or practice while the investigation's going on. That's never happened unless there have been criminal charges.
Yeah. And Shira, is he practicing?
So, yes, he was at practice today wearing number one, a temporary number. And again, Bill Belichick, when asked if he would play on Sunday against the Dolphins, said, well, we're taking it day by day. You know, that's very Belichickian, not revealing anything before it actually needs to be revealed.
Yeah. So I want to talk about Belichick. We have very limited time, but yeah. I want to talk about him a little bit more. I watched his very short, very terse
two minutes from his introductory statement to when he sort of rushed himself off.
That's right.
The podium.
That's right. And I wanna play a clip here when people asked him, what do you owe to the fans?
Bill, were you aware of the lawsuit when you signed Antonio Brown?
I'm not going to be expanding on the statements that have already been given.
Don't you think the fans deserve to hear a little more from you on
when we know more, we'll say more.
That, you know, could impact the team?
Yeah, I just said that.
Don't you think fans deserve to hear a little bit more?
When we know more, we'll say more.
So, Shira, do the fans deserve to hear a little more from that? I mean, does he have an obligation here, or is that, oh, Belichick's going to be Belichick and this is just how it's going to run?
I think in an ideal world, you would like to think that, you know, a team like the Patriots does owe something to their fans, you know, more transparency about something like this. And I'd be curious from the callers if it has changed their perception or their rooting interest in the Patriots. But to be honest, he doesn't really owe them anything. He is just in charge of football. His job is to win games. And as long as he does that, he has fulfilled the obligation of his contract. But what I do think is very interesting, and you heard a little bit of it at that press conference, was how much the press was pushing back. This was not, by the way, the typical group of beat reporters. There were reporters beyond beat reporters, news reporters, and they were really giving it to Belichick and not letting him off the hook with Antonio Brown. And I remember my reaction, and Chris and I were kind of talking about this beforehand too, and saying, have we reached a tipping point? You know, are we seeing something new? Because usually Belichick can sort of control the narrative with his, you know, just this is where we're staying, focus on football. But I got a glimpse of something a little bit different today, that, you know what, we have crossed a line where the media and maybe the fans now too are not just going to take Belichick's word for it and take the Patriots' word for it, and they're going to push back a little bit.
All right. So that's WBUR Sports and Society reporter Shira Springer. Shira, thanks.
Thank you.
And Radio Boston's Chris Sitterick. Chris, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
That is our show for today. We are a production of 90.9 WBUR. Tune in again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.